You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hi, Nick.
How you doing, man?
I'm feeling much better.
You're recovered. Good Lord.
I've recovered.
I was really concerned for a second there because it wasn't just the COVID, but you also had like the nostril, like if I might share.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, I got COVID. And then as I was recovering from COVID, I don't know if it was like a cold.
Yeah.
Or it was a COVID part two. It was something. And suddenly, like, I literally could not breathe out of my nose for like a week.
That's
which
insane,
I don't know if that's
man.
Ever happened to you, but it's the worst feeling that there is.
Yeah. No, that is the worst. When you can't breathe, it's
oh my God.
Natural. It's bad.
Yeah. It's just like the best way possible way to end 2020 that I could think of.
Yeah. Just get COVID.
It just complete misery.
Yeah. You know, I want to point out, though, one thing, you know, now obviously COVID is a very serious disease, and anybody who has it, who is living with it, who has lost loved ones to it, we love you and we send you so much healing energy and good vibes, because it's serious shit. But in your specific case, Alex, now
yes.
You spent 2020 recording this podcast with me, and you spent it in pursuit of my wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. 2020 and every year prior.
So I just want to make sure that you understand
that
I'm not saying it was karma, but I am saying stay away from my family. Do you know what I mean?
You're saying that I got COVID as cosmic punishment.
Yes.
For pursuing Sarah.
Yes. How do you feel about that, man?
I would do it all over again.
Fuck you.
Little justice. Fuck yeah.
What does Sarah get? Why does she not get punished? She's part of this.
No, she didn't get shit. Welcome to Little Justice. She is part of it. She's really part of it.
Well, it takes two to tango.
It does.
Okay.
It does. She absolutely is in there. Guys, you know, we're back. Alex is recovered. We are back recording these wonderful episodes. And we have one of the most amazing guests ever to this week. A young man who has kind of made his mark on not only the podcast industry, but also the improv industry, the theater industry, the acting industry, and also just being a genuinely good human being industry. Michael Paul Smith, welcome to the show, my friend.
Hey, guys. I am transfixed by that conversation I was just eavesdropping on. Wow.
It's always so awkward when we have a guest on and we have to do our cold open and know that the guest is just sitting there like waiting for us to finish our bullshit.
I was riveted.
I love it because it sets, you know, if you listen to our cold open, it's going to set up the tone for the entire thing. So like, if you thought you were coming to something that wasn't this, now you know.
Oh my God. And when we have more serious guests too, it's just like people who like are real industry professional, like big types who like, we're just like Michael, you're just like a friend of ours. Like we're happy to shoot the shit with you and all that. But when we have people on who like maybe we haven't talked to since we approached them to do our podcast, all that, and we make them sit there and listen to us talk about how I'm going to steal Nick's wife and
it's
we're going to murder each other one day. Oh, it's terrible.
and it's also
completely
funny,
unprofessional.
It's also funny, Michael, because one of the things that I learned from watching you guys do your podcast was that efficiency of time, because, you know, especially with Hamilcast and with all, you know, with the pods that you guys do over there. You guys are smart enough to record your cold opens without the guests listening. You record them on your own time. We don't do that here.
It might just be that we forget to do it until the end, and then we're just like, oh, it's just us. Oh, we'll just do it. We'll just get it over with.
But it's
probably smarter.
It's smarter. And then you're not, it's not crazy. It's not awkward. But more importantly, let's get to you, man. So how are you doing? How's life? How's your soul? How you feeling?
I'm doing great. I have to ask if Alex is Alex. Can you smell yet again? Because I am a Little Justice listener. As I shouted from the rooftops, and so I'm concerned about your sense of smell.
I appreciate your concern. That means a lot to me. Here's the thing: I never really had a sense of smell to begin
with.
Jesus
Christ!
Weird thing about me. Like there's something going on. One day I will get it figured out. I could smell technically. If something's really bad, I can smell it. Every now and then I'll get a whiff of coffee or something like that. But kind of as a rule, my smell is my most muted sense. So I couldn't really tell if it had disappeared. My wife, on the other hand, she could tell immediately, and also her taste. Mm-hmm. Cause those two things are pretty interconnected. I definitely noticed the taste thing. So you've
gotten back what little smell you had.
I've gotten back what little smell that I had.
All right. Yeah,
I think it's one of those things that you just get used to it after a while. You just think, oh, this is how the world is, right? Like, everybody can only smell a little bit.
Right.
But it's really not true. I really need to get checked out.
Yeah, you should go to a doctor, man.
I really should go to a doctor.
You know, when we're out of lockdown. Because this is interesting, because Michael, you're not in lockdown yet, right? New York is still, you guys are still popping and moving a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that we were before. But I think, the laws are always changing, and I'm such a homebody anyway, and I'm taking every precaution. So, like, I'm not like refreshing the New York One Twitter like I would be if I had to just like be outside all the time. But I think the schools are still closed. It's still remote learning and stuff like that. And I think the bars and restaurants are getting more and more restricted. I think they're only allowed to be open till 9 now. It's getting back to those days. I saw today that most of 25% of the fatalities are in Staten Island, where only 5% of the population is.
Dude.
So I don't know what
it's that's a lot doing. Of people who are not wearing masks down there is what's happening.
It's really crazy. And I'm not, again, we're not trying to shame anybody here, but at a certain point, you know, because I've been watching the Cuomo briefings. And again, I've said this earlier on this pod. I don't, you know, Cuomo, not my favorite politician, but I cannot argue with the way that he's handled this pandemic, and he really has handled it. And it's really amazing to see. But the thing is, you know, you watch the briefings and he's talking about Staten Island, and it's like, you had the dude, what's that? I don't know this gentleman's name, but the guy who was running the bar, illegally, you know, without COVID.
Yeah, that guy.
And then ran his, Alex, I don't know if you heard about this. This dude, when he was getting, his place got shut down, this guy gets in his car and runs his car into a freaking deputy and drives with him on the hood of his car for, like, I think it's like 100 yards or some shit. Like, just out of protest because, you know, you're cutting in on our freedoms. And it's like, y'all, Staten Island, I don't know what y'all are smoking over there, but please get with the program.
That's nuts. Well, here's where we're getting now is, like, because it's been going on for so long, it really is. There are so many people's livelihoods who are disappearing, and it's a no-win situation. I do think that politically it's gotten very, very confused.
Yes,
it's a very hard situation. And I know in LA, in California, they're making some questionable calls in terms of, you know, what can stay open and what can't.
Yeah.
It's because there's no science to back it up. It's easy to shut down restaurants, but you can't shut down the Hollywood money. You can't shut down shoots. You can't shut down things. So there's that woman who was losing her restaurant. She can't open her restaurant, and watching right across the street, a film crew eat in the same exact way under a tent outside that she had set up at her restaurant.
No,
you know, and it's, I get that everyone needs to be safe and that we need to do this in the right way. But I think it's gotten very, very messy. When the people who are making those calls about how to do it are you know,
going to dinner parties,
yanking everybody around and going to dinner parties and taking vacations. And
yeah,
I get where the frustrations are, but don't run your car into people.
Don't do that. And this is, and Michael, I don't know what you think about this, but this is something that I've thought about often, because I'm like, at the end of the day, you know, Alex talks about doing it right. How you do this right is you pay people to shut down. If you're going to have somebody shut down their business, then they need to get paid. And
absolutely.
I think that, you know what I mean? That's just something that's happening. But
and I think the messy part is that people then equate, like, oh, well, then I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm not going to adhere to any of it.
Yeah.
Right. The whole thing gets all lumped together. Like, I'm not going to let them tell me what to do. Like, no, wear a mask. Like, the science is obvious in that regard. Like, be safe for other people. And I don't know. We're going to get through this thing. We're going to get through this thing.
No, hey, we started those vaccines, y'all. Started those vaccines.
Yeah, I'm sick of having to start every episode of this podcast with a description of what's going on in the world right now.
Listen.
Yeah, it's true.
That will always be the case, but the vaccines are coming. We're hanging tight.
England vaccinated that lovely 90-year-old lady in the Christmas sweater.
Oh, yeah.
She was the first one.
Love her. love her. And I love the dude in Britain who's like, well, listen, I, you know, it's too late to die now. Like, I'm just getting back. Just like, yeah, good for you, man. Good boy. Good boy. You get it. You get it. But, you know, most importantly, you know, we're just trying to, yeah, I agree with you, Alex, that it always sucks having to open talking about goddamn COVID, but we do have
it does, but yeah, if you go back and listen to all the episodes all the way through, it really does document
where we've been,
the progression, where we've been,
and where we're going, and what joy.
And where are we going right now?
Well, right now, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about this young man.
Document. Oh, you missed
I don't see. I know what you're doing, but I'm not ready to go there yet. See, Michael, Alex is trying to pivot.
It was too soon.
Oh, I know. Again, I'm a listener, you guys. I know the ongoing debate over who gets to pivot.
Yeah. You're looking out for the pivot. Did I pivot too early?
You pivoted. I think I might have pivoted too early. You pivoted too early because we got to talk about
the opportunity is there when opportunity presents itself.
You are an opportunity and you need to not present yourself. Okay. I'm trying to talk about this young man's amazing radio play, Twas the Night. Oh, do you know what I mean? Before we get to anything about our movies, we got to talk about the fact that Michael is spreading so much joy. So, Michael, talk to us about this because you know, you have Ted and Michael read sketches in the microphones. You've done work at the Irish Rep. You are an improv actor. You are a theater actor, and you wrote this. This started as a play, correct? Before it was a radio play, this was an actual just original play. So, yeah, what was this for you?
This was something that I wrote over a Memorial Day weekend because I wished it was Christmas. I'm such a Christmas and winter fan. In fact, all of my major gift buying happens in December because it's my wedding anniversary, it's Jillian's birthday, it's our dating anniversary, and it's Christmas. It all happens for me in December. So I wrote that, and then it got produced a few years ago by my friends at Long Island Theater Collective, which is a company on Long Island, where I'm from. And a couple years later, we did it in the city as a reading, and I got my manager from that reading. And yes, for you actors out there, industry people occasionally still go to things in person. At least they will again.
Yes.
Once this whole thing blows over. And now we're doing it as a radio play. So I've had to like retrofit it each time and tighten the screws on it each time as we go along. But it is essentially, it's a comedy about a family in the present day in New York City, and the entire poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, also known as Twas the Night Before Christmas by Clement Clark Moore. The entire poem happens to them down to every last detail that I could possibly justify.
Brilliant.
So it starts off with the mom, if you will, convincing her husband to wear these old timey Christmas pajamas. Because as I'm writing it, I'm like, well, I got to get her in a kerchief and I got to get him in a cap if we're going to do this. And then on and on we go from there. And it's a terrifying ordeal for them for the most part. And they're convinced that her younger brother is playing a cruel joke on them. And so who is my favorite young sounding prankster that I know?
It's me.
Nick Walker. Nick Walker plays the younger brother. And Nick, you have a very tricky role in this because you're very, very funny, but you also, there's also like a cathartic, serious conversation that he has with his sister. And they sort of like, they talk some things out, some family history sort of things. And you nail it. You kill it. And I hope it makes you proud.
How old is this character?
He's supposed to be a freshman in college.
Oh, okay. So you're not doing like a little kid voice.
No,
not doing a little kid voice. I haven't had to do one of those since I was a freshman in college. but no, you know, it's so funny because I get an email from Michael and Jillian, you know, being like, this was like months ago. Like, hey, Twas the Night. We're trying to get this thing together. You know, it's going to be a big thing. We got Mischief Man behind it. We got all these cool people. And look, the thing, you know, you get to, you know, as all of us are artists, how often have we had the question, you know, read each other's scripts and do each other's projects and all this thing. And that's what happens, right? And it's it's very rare that you open those emails and like it's like a thing that like actually grabs you and actually and I gotta say again, just and I will be, as you are a herald of our projects, I will be a herald of yours. You are fucking hysterical, dude. And so my job on that recording was literally just to show up and read your words. And it was very easy. You know what I mean? Like you have it so well put out, and it's not like, again, it's not like you're dealing with small potatoes. I mean, literally this show is like a Hamilton reunion from like every generation of Hamilton. You got C-Jack in there. You got James Iglehart being an idiot. You have me, you have Lexi Garcia, Fergie, everybody.
That's and quite a cast.
Eddie Lee. Yeah.
Eddie Lee shows up. Oh my God. Yeah. It's and not to mention Patrick Hines and Jillian and yourself.
Patrick Hines?
Yep. Patrick Hines, he's in there.
And Anissa Folds from Freestyle Love Supreme, who plays opposite me. She plays the mom.
Who I recently met on the Chaos Twins, and she is just such a delight, such a wonderful, wonderful person.
She is. She knocked it out in two recording days.
I love
She's,
it.
She's yeah. Couldn't have asked for better.
Yeah, dude.
So how can I get my hands on this thing then?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be in the Hamilcast feed. And it's also going to be at twasthenightplay.com. And the Hamilcast, anyone that listens to it knows that they don't have ads. This, we will have one sponsor for this radio play, and it is the Actors Fund. It's just a fundraiser for the Actors Fund. So that's why it's going to be in those two places. And it's, of course, executive produced by my great and powerful, inspiring wife, Jillian Pensavalli.
There you go.
And I'm excited for that. Nick, if I wrote something, would you be in what I wrote you?
Now, here's the thing, Michael. He asked this question. I was in something that he wrote. You know what I mean? And exactly. Alex likes to credit my entire career to him. And I can't deny that he did give me my start in a way. In a way. There's a short film called Borderland that's actually really good.
It made you. Yeah.
It did make me.
The question is, would you ever trust me again?
I
with anything
debatable now that
it's,
I know
it's debatable yeah
but
was
know.
It not an ideal onset experience for you?
No,
Nick?
Here's the thing, actually, if I'm speaking real, and you know what, it's holiday time, so I'm gonna be so nice.
Please speak real, be real.
It was one of the most fun times I've had on set, 100%, just because it was, I think that we were all, I think Alex, as much as I hate to give him credit, he had a really good fucking idea. And he knew exactly what he wanted out of that shoot. And we, you know, it was me and my buddies making this war film and really pushing each other. And I think that especially with me and Luke, who was Luke Humphrey, who was also in it, you know, we kind of had this, like, you know, we were we were two cocky young actors coming right at NYU. So we were trying to out-act each other. That was like, yeah.
And it was one of those ideal situations too for actors, where it the whole movie is just two people talking to each other in a really dramatic situation.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of rehearsals were great because it's just the three of us sitting there rehearsing. And I mean, the night before we were going to shoot, this huge like historic storm rolled through and messed everything up. So we had to kind of like retool the script to fit. Like suddenly night became day, and it was raining the whole time, and all this stuff. But like we used that time to like hunker down in the basement and rehearse over and over and over again, and like work it. And it's kind of a dream situation.
Awesome. Alex had one bit of direction for me though, and this you know, when I was doing this recording with Michael, Michael was actually being a great director. And giving me like, oh, yeah,
right. Doing things that directors should do. Yeah.
Try this. Alex, what was your one phrase of direction for me on that set?
Well, I think every good actor should remember if there is something in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
That you can pull from.
Yeah, yeah.
Use it.
That's all he would say to me, Michael. He would say,
use it.
Use it.
Use your life.
That's it. Oh. And just like, and it would be like about things. I'd be like, Alex, like when is lunch getting here? When's Crafty opening up? Use it. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Oh, are you hungry? Are you getting irritated? Use it.
Use it.
Uh-huh.
I hate it so much.
And the film turned out really well. So
it did. You know. It did. No, it really did.
So what do I have to do to get you guys in a meeting? You want me to facilitate this?
Let's go, Michael. You say the word we're gonna make it happen.
All right,
but
done.
In the meantime, you know, before, why don't we document this wonderful reunion of ours?
I already did it. I like that. I took the steam as
damn it.
I can't let you have it. I can't let you,
you already
have
pivoted.
That. That's my thing.
You already pivoted.
Okay.
That was the smoothest pivot you've done so far, Nick, because some of your other ones were pretty clumsy, I have to say.
Oh, I agree. No,
you've had some
terrible
pivots. You've had some bad ones.
I'm really bad at pivoting, yeah. Guys. No, thank you. No, but yeah, today we wanted to do the documentary movie, and we also had this funny moment where we realized that that is such a broad definition. Like, we were like, oh yeah.
So we set this up, and I texted Nick, like, I think we should do a documentary movie. Like, in the beginning stages of figuring out what topic to go with, let's do a documentary this time, thinking, okay, a specific kind of documentary. That's like, there's I don't know. Yeah. Documentary itself, I guess, is technically a genre, but it's more a style.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Michael, do you watch a lot of documentary movies? Have you had experience with them?
I do, yeah. I watch a ton. I mean, as some of you know, my wife also recaps true crime documentaries for one of her podcasts. So I wind up having to watch a lot of those. There are certain documentaries that I will put on because they inspire me so much that I'll just put them on while I write instead of music.
Interesting.
One of my choices is one of those.
I love that.
But yeah, I love documentaries.
Interesting.
They tend to be
because I usually put on narrative films to get inspired, like a product of a creative thing. Instead, because documentaries they get pretty real. You got to pay attention. So what is it about documentary instead of like a fiction film that inspires you creatively?
Well, specifically, I can't tell you about this one because it's got to be a reveal. But my favorite thing to write to was probably Ken Burns Jazz, because it just puts me in this creative world.
Well, yeah.
And I don't have to worry about it for a while. I can just let it play.
Yeah.
Ken Burns in general, yeah, as a whole, that's a whole genre unto himself. I mean, that's a...
I think that's the only way to get through an entire Ken Burns series.
You got
to
do other things.
Doing something else at the same time. Yeah,
totally.
It gets rough. It gets rough over there. But that's why, I mean, and this is, you know, again, Michael, we're probably going to have you back, because documentary is such a big, expansive genre. Mm. There's so many, just like so many of the things we pick, there's so many little pockets within it that, you know, we're going to pick these movies and tell you about these movies, but not the end by any means. You know, we're going to have a lot more to talk about.
My only question to Nick when he said documentary was, I said, does it have to be a documentary that had a theatrical release? And he said no, because so many of them don't. So I was just like, "That would be
a good question, though." That's the thing about documentary, right? Is it's all drawn from real life stuff. Even if there's like, you know, they reenact things or whatever, everything's being drawn from and about real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where was I going with this? I've still got this COVID brain fog where I start in one place and then I end up somewhere else.
I don't like that. I don't like that.
I don't like that either. I had a point to make and I can't find it. That's the first time that's ever happened.
Terrifying.
Wow.
Yikes.
Terrifying.
Yikes, yikes. Well, how about this? While you're in your brain fog, we're going to take a break. And when I say a break, sometimes, you know, here's the thing, guys. Sometimes we take these breaks and there isn't an ad playing for some stupid reason. So if there isn't an ad playing, then we'll just see you in like a second. It's going to be really awkward. But if there is an ad playing, you're going to listen to the ad, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about movies. All right. So let's see what happens now.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I love that.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Does that really happen?
Oh, yeah. Because sometimes the Spotify, especially on Spotify, it takes a second for them to put the ad in. So, like, it just won't show up for, like,
a
week.
No.
And I'm like, and then you listen to it and you're like, yo, there's like a blanks. We said
I listened to a couple of sports podcasts where they throw to commercial like that, but they don't have sponsors. So they will literally knowingly just be like, all right, and right after this break, hey, we're back.
We're back.
I have one guy, he does an Islanders podcast, and he does like station identification at the end of the, at the end of every episode. But it's like, dude, it's a podcast. I had to click on this to listen to it. I know who you are.
Right. You know where it
is. Like, Mike Carver, ILC podcast, signing off. Like, what?
Oh, my God.
You're not on the radio.
But he should be. And that's what he's saying.
Yeah, he definitely has that mindset.
I belong.
I'm gonna start signing off from this.
He should.
Alex Smolo for a little justice.
Exactly.
I love it. I love it. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. But we are back. We're talking about documentary films, documentary movies. We're going to discuss them. So this is going to be interesting, guys, because I got to be honest. I don't know a lot of documentaries, so I'm not going to be able to get these. I'm worried about that. But I'm not going to be able to guess them.
Do you not? Yeah, Nick. Do you not watch documentaries?
I do watch documentaries, but not enough that like if you're not talking about a documentary that I've seen, will I be able to guesstimate it? No. Do you know what I mean? Like, I do. I watch now. What I do watch is a lot of mockumentaries, which are not documentaries at all.
Well, yeah,
but
very different. We will definitely do
that. It's another great episode idea, though.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We will have to.
Yeah, you got to come back for that one.
We will have to. Well, so documentaries are tough to single out because there's so many different types.
Yes.
Like the true crime documentary, obviously, Jillian knows this very well. Is its own thing. And I think it's been really enhanced by television in the last few years.
Yep.
Where, you know, it's interesting. Crime is interesting. People getting murdered, as terrible as it is interesting. People doing things and getting away with it. People, unsolved mysteries. It's always been a fascinating thing to people. So it's taken its own little niche, right? Its own little chunk of the documentary world where you almost have to separate between crime documentaries and other.
Yeah.
Because at the root of a documentary, it's if you're doing it right, the idea is to answer the question of who are we?
Yeah.
Right. Who are we actually? Who are we underneath our facade? What are these things going on in our world? What, you know, so I think the best documentaries are the ones that engage with that and answer it. And it could be about crime and still give us that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And I love the stories that still manage to get told, right? It's, you know, it's not just a snapshot. It's not just a picture. It's also, you know, learning these lessons from the past or from, I mean, it has to be the past because it's documenting something that happened. You know, so it really is kind of this perfect little, you know, insight to who we are. It almost reminds me of the essay film, right? Adam McKay is kind of at the forefront right now doing films that are also basically essays, and you set it up with a thesis and then you go through and show the evidence for that thesis. And I think the best documentaries are just well-written pieces of argument, you know, well-crafted. So yeah, guys,
does a good documentary have to take a subject and reveal something new about it, or is engagement enough?
Huh. Michael, what you think?
I think I always learn something new if it's a good documentary, but I always think like, oh, that whenever I learn something new in a documentary, I watch a lot of historical documentaries. Yep. And so I usually feel a sense of shame. Like, oh, I probably should have known that. I should have known that by now. So I don't know if they reveal something new to everyone, but I think in my experience, they do.
You know, it's so funny because I've been falling asleep to, I take that back, because I've been falling asleep to a lot of BBC history documentaries, like ancient Rome, like all that stuff. And I think that they do reveal those truths, right? Because you know, Michael, you say you shouldn't know that, or you should know that, but it's like some of this stuff is so specific, right? Some of this stuff is just, you know, yeah, you might get the general sense, but a documentary is going to be the thing, you know, that shows you. I remember there's the documentary that came out. I hope this isn't anyone's choice. Did anyone choose a documentary that was produced by Peter Jackson? No?
No.
Good. Negative.
Good. So there's a documentary that came out. Peter Jackson produced it about World War One. Did you? They shall not grow old.
They shall not grow old. Ooh, that would have been a good choice, actually.
It would have been a great choice. And I mean, Michael, did you hear about this one?
Yes. Just heard about it, though. Didn't see it.
So I went to see it. I forget what city we were in. I think it might have been like Portland or Seattle. And it was beautiful because he, you know, the kind of the gimmick of this documentary was that he took World War One footage and colorized it. So you're looking at these guys and
not just colorized it, but changed because cameras back then recorded at a different frame rate, right? It's why everything looks a little jumpy, moves a little faster than reality. You get that old timey feel.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He filled in the empty frames.
Yeah.
In addition to colorizing it, expanding the image, they literally, I mean, Weta went in and completely turned this footage into stuff that it looks now. So what it does is it gives you this sense that World War One, which feels like something out of an old textbook, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's literally 100 years ago.
It's so distant.
Yeah.
It makes it feel so relevant. You see how young these kids were. You see how bad it got, crazy and brutal and violent and hopeful. And it's without any real, it just let it speak for itself, right? It used old newsreel, you know.
Yeah, you had
speeches and stuff.
Yeah, you had some, I think you had a lot of actors coming in and reading these texts and these letters from guys.
Right, letters and stuff, yeah.
And but it was just powerful when you saw that was kind of the thing that was revealed, right? Was all of a sudden there was no distance between you and these men. You really understood that these were people that could have been right next to you. You know, you could be, you know, it's they're just babies. They're little babies out in fighting this war. And it was really effective. So, you know, I think a documentary can, even if it's a topic that we ostensibly know about, you know, World War One, World War Two, I think a good documentary shows you something you didn't know, you know, in a great way. So yeah. Do we want to, you know, as always, we save our guest for last. You have the seat of honor. Alex, do you want me to go or do you want to go?
I can go first because mine's pretty light fare. Again, I find myself, we get into these, I find myself choosing, when I don't know what to choose, I go with my comfort movies and the things that I love, right? Because at the end of the day, this is about what we think is the best. I don't know that this is, to me, the best documentary or the best use of documentary, because there's so much good stuff that does so much groundbreaking work.
Yeah.
This is the only documentary that I've seen more than three times.
Love it.
I've watched this movie 6, 7, 8, 9. I don't even know. I just keep coming back to it. It launched the career of its director in a big way. And I don't know, there's just something about it that really resonates with me on a human level. And I just think it's a beautiful film. So yeah, you'll get it immediately and call it out, because I wasn't actually able to track down a copy. So I'm going from memory here.
I love that.
Complete memory. And I watched another documentary in preparation for this and decided to go with this one instead.
I love that.
We open on a table to a line delivered in Japanese.
Roger and
what?
Me.
No.
Oh, man. I thought outsourcing launched his career. Damn.
No.
Got it.
But that'd be a good one, though. No, the line is, what is the essence of flavor?
Oh, Jesus. What's sushi? Yes.
The film is Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Yeah. Aw, yeah, you do love this one.
Because back from college, whenever it came out, Jiro Dreams of Sushi is a documentary. And let me get his full name so I can botch it. it is... it is a Japanese language American documentary film that follows Jiro Ono. That's what it is. Jiro Ono is a sushi master who owns a small little shop underground in a subway station. And it's the only sushi restaurant to have been awarded 3 Michelin stars. He's considered the best sushi chef in the entire world.
Wow.
He's a little old man, super just like adorable man. Who makes sushi, and that's all he does, and that's all he's done for his entire life. And it follows, you know, it starts out as sort of a it's almost like a class. It's almost like they're asking him, he's delivering his thesis to you, right? He's talking about how he sees the art of making sushi. Over the course of the film, what happens as they sit with him more, as they spend more time with him, as they follow him, you know, there's a tradition in Japan of going to visit your ancestors' graves, following him to his parents' graves and hearing the kind of side talk, seeing his relationship with his son, who's coming up underneath him, but he refuses to retire so the son can never really take over. You realize that he's gotten to where he is because of his work ethic, which in the beginning is presented to you as something to aspire to. You start to see the ramifications of it, right? His kids grew up without him there because he worked. He was gone before they woke up, and he came back after they were asleep. He's critical to a fault. He leaves his employees in tears. It's just such a heartbreaking and lovely portrait of a person that really, you know, it takes somebody who is the best at something and allows them just by talking to them, just by spending time with them and seeing where they are and what they do and how they feel about it, you know, it reveals so much about human character and about ambition and about profession and about family. And it's shot beautifully. I don't know. It's so good. Geo Dreams of Sushi.
I remember it having almost like a meditative quality.
It is. Yeah. The music is very, it's almost Philip Glass like.
Yeah.
Which the other film that I picked had a score by Philip Glass. I thought this actually reminds me of Jiro a lot, because the idea and what this spawned was, what's the show? Chef's Table. Mm-hmm. So the director of this went on to do Chef's Table for Netflix, which is the same thing where you're taking just like the most beautiful images of food that mm-hmm. you could have, right?
It's a great
sushi
series.
Is a very, yeah. Sushi is a very simple food, right? The beauty is in the simplicity. It's just a little piece of something on a little black plate. And for somehow they find ways to make every individual shot of this food just like gorgeous. Like you just, your mouth waters and you can taste it. And you're listening to people explain what it tastes like as you're watching it. And it became this fixation for me when I first saw it, wanting to go to Japan and like have this sushi.
A beautiful, I think back to, when back in the early Hamilton days, not early Hamilton days, but the early tour days, I should say, me and Sarah, went to Paris and we stayed with, a family friend or stayed in a family friend's apartment in Paris for free. So all of our money for the vacation was spent on food, and Sarah lined up like literally like five star. I mean, it was, I think we went to the, like, I think it was like the 24th highest ranked restaurant in the world. And we ate this food, and like when food is made at that level where it's just like, it's an art form. When you taste it, it is something, it truly is something transcendent. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, you have brought every ounce of flavor out of this meal. And that's what I remember about this movie. And it also reminds me of, I don't know if any of you watch Documentary Now, but their parody of it is one of my favorite episodes.
Did they do one of this?
Oh my god, it's called Juan Likes Rice and Chicken, and it's Fred Armisen as like this like I think he's it has to be like some South American his restaurant is on like the top of like a hill, like it looks like Machu Picchu, and like you have to travel for days to get there, and they only make one dish, and it's just a plate of rice and like chicken with like a little dollop of butter on the top. But apparently it's like the most incredible thing you've ever had in your life. And like his son, you know, is trying to be be, you know, following his father's footsteps, but he can't. And his father has like all these ridiculous things about how he prepares the chicken and like shoots the chicken out of like a t-shirt cannon. And like, it's all ridiculous. Like,
that's so funny.
Oh my God. It's brilliant. It's
yeah, that's really funny. I mean, that's kind of what this is, right? Because like sushi is, like I said, it's a very simple food.
Yeah.
And I think it plays to the themes of it, right? Is finding the beauty in simplicity and always, even for something so simple, being able to get up and strive every day to be a little bit better, try a little bit harder, make it a little more perfect. Like it's such a good metaphor.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna watch that. See, now I'm gonna watch that.
You should watch it again. I'm looking at it now. Actually, it is Philip Glass music. they did use Philip, not made specifically for this film. I think they used his music from other stuff and put it in, but it's a lot of Philip Glass.
There's an episode of I guess it's No Reservations. It was one of the two Anthony Bourdain shows. Yeah, and he visited someone that was makes noodles by hand, and there's apparently only a handful of them left, and he was just in total awe, and they captured it in the show, at just the exactly like you said, like what it takes to do one thing that well,
yeah,
and to do it by hand and to just devote your time to it. And yeah. I was just like, I randomly think of that. It's like one of those episodes that it just pops into my head sometimes.
Cause you think about what is that, who is that person who can devote themselves like that? Like there's so many more questions that when you see somebody who has the fortitude to do something like that, like who are they? And I think this film does a really good job of peeling that away, because he's not a person who gives it away. It's not like he sits down and is ready to completely open up about who he is and all that. He's got his like hardcore principles, and I'm sure, you know, the speeches he's delivered to his employees over time, I'm sure he's just regurgitating to the camera about how important it is to be focused and always try your hardest in your career and always be better. It's when it goes beyond that, it's when you really get the glimpse at the toll that takes, at the human toll, that the film kind of elevates. So I mean, as a documentary, I think the best documentaries can take reality and reveal something more about it in one way or another, whether, you know, directly or indirectly, and this film does that for sure.
How do you guys eat sushi? What do you put on it?
You gotta eat it.
go
Oh no, well, it depends. If you're eating like Bristol Farm sushi, then you got to get some soy sauce and some ginger and do it up. But if you're going to Jiro's restaurant, you take it how it's served.
Yeah, I have never had, I want to have sushi that I don't have to put anything on. That's just like, you know, when you get like that steak that, you know, is just, you don't put any, like to put sauce on it would be an offense. I want to have that sushi. I have not had that.
It's not as hard to find as you think, and it's not expensive. There's a place I love in LA. Yeah. That does that where it's good. It's good enough. They prepare it well enough, individually, that you don't, they tell you as they give it to you, yes, soy sauce, no soy sauce, like needs it, doesn't need it. Cause they start to do little things, right? If it needs wasabi, they put the wasabi under the fish, like between the fish and the rice. If it needs soy sauce, they'll brush it on top, stuff like that. When somebody really knows what they're doing, they're not going for just quantity. They're not sitting back there just churning out factory sushi for the masses. It's like an art form.
Oh yeah. No, there's,
it's beautiful.
I'm hungry. I'm hungry too. You know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about at Morimoto Asia in Disney Springs, they got that a grade A Wagyu beef.
I bet they do.
Oh, it's you don't even know. You don't even know. It is. It will make you smack your mom in the face. It's so good.
Hey, babe, you want sushi tonight?
You asshole.
Yes.
I hate you. Beautiful. Jiro dreams of sushi. That is Alex Smalley's choice. All right.
Watching it tonight.
I'm gonna watch tonight too. Or if you wanna possibly laugh, you might wanna watch my selection. Because this documentary is, I don't think it's like like just like you said, Alex, I don't think it's like the perfect documentary. I really don't. But I when it came out in 2019. And when I watched it, I was just so I was laughing my ass off. I was also just so upset with the world. It was just one of those things where you're like, this is real. Like, this is a real thing. And like, this is the world that we live in. But I was also just so entertained. It was just so fascinating on so many levels. So I'll describe the opening, and I'm gonna kind of paraphrase from memory the opening lines of this. Because it opens on very simple images. It opens on first you see a house, and then you see an Instagram post, and then you see people liking the Instagram post, and then you see a party. But this is the voice that is said over it.
You're living in your parents' basement, and you pull out your phone, which you look at 100 times an hour.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations.
You see a music festival that exceeds all expectations on a deserted island owned by Pablo Escobar.
These wonderful, beautiful people in places that you're not doing, things you could never do. Guys, and here's the thing. Two documentaries came out about this moment, but there's only one that I think the HBO one is bullshit. I'm sorry, I'm gonna call them bullshit on that, because the guys who made Fire Festival made the documentary on HBO. Yeah.
Really?
Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah, that's bullshit. Isn't it, then
it's crazy.
Or it's like Life is Art as Life.
Oh my god, no. The one that I'm talking about is Fire Fraud on Hulu. The Hulu
that's
documentary.
That's the one.
That's the one.
There was music, private planes, and beautiful women swimming on an island with drugs. Man, that's about as sexy as it gets.
We were all packed into a yellow school bus, and people are thinking, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen?
Guys, I watched this shit this morning before my class, and I was laughing my, because it's just like, you guys are like, we have literally built our own graves. Like, we're that dumb, guys. We are yep, that dumb.
And this is pre-COVID.
This is pre-COVID. This is pre-COVID when this man, Billy McFarland, duped all of these like Instagram celebrities to come out to his island. Like, it's so ridiculous. So he like, it's like marketing. Just superpowers. He like puts out that like they're gonna have this like exclusive festival, and it's gonna be like you can like swim with like island pigs and like Caitlyn Jenner and all this stuff, and like it's just crazy. And they like flew out, and like Ja Rule became part of it, right? Because it all started because Billy McFarland figured out like he wanted to do like a new kind of like Soho Beach House membership credit card style thing, right? So he was like, oh well, I'm just gonna make like an exclusive credit card for like young millennials, and he literally just ordered a bunch of like black metal and cut it into credit cards, and like the credit card had no actual value, but he was just able to drum up enough like exclusivity that people bought into it. And then from that, Ja Rule got involved, and then from that they created the Fire Festival, which, guys, it just is so ridiculous watching this thing count down. Because he puts out, it's like we have this saying, you know, and I'm sure Michael, you can attest to this. Like, when you're trying to create something, there is no better motivator to putting out a poster for the thing you're trying to create. For telling,
yeah, it's terrifying, but yes,
right? Because once it's out, you have to do it. Like, if you, and that's exactly what they did. They put out, we're gonna throw the biggest, most exclusive festival, music festival that's ever been festivaled, and they put out all this shit about it, and they did not have one iota of knowledge of how to structure a music festival. So like, there's
like, it's a slightly complicated process to put a music festival.
They knew how to take everyone's money, though.
They knew how to take every single like, person's money.
Just pay in advance.
But like, that's exactly right. They were having them buy into like, yeah, we have these like amazing tent suites with like hammocks and all this shit. And then they're like building these like hazmat huts. Like, they're like, we have 5-star food from the finest chefs. And it's like you see this picture of this sandwich that's in a styrofoam box. Like, yep. It just is shit. It was the funniest thing. I was like, you all got fucked. You all
it's such a beautiful portrait.
Oh my God.
of American or maybe global stupidity, like the stupidity of social media and everyone's urge to like fall in. It's like the world's full of people like Billy McFarland, right? And this guy, I'm sure he doesn't hold any remorse, right? He's a hustler.
Yeah.
He's Donald Trump. He doesn't care who he hurts. He wakes up and says, how the hell can I get people to give me as much money as possible today? And it doesn't matter how you do it. And it doesn't matter what's happening. And he probably doesn't even think it's wrong. Right. He's just on this other like weird level. I think it's so fascinating to watch how many people are so hungry to feel like they're doing something cooler than the next guy that they're partaking in something exclusive and rich. And that because they've bought into this fantasy and it completely translates to the Trump presidency and to everything, in that sense, because it's like, oh no, there's nothing there. Like the emperor has no clothes on
at all. And it's brilliant because I just want to point out this young man is 28 years old, guys, 28 years old. So it's not even like, so when he was doing this, when Fyre Festival happened, he was what, 26, 24? Do you mean like it's insane. And it's literally like a generation of people who watched The Social Network and were like, oh, I can do that. I'm like a crazy, I'll write equations on Windows just like Andrew Garfield. I mean, like, it's like, no, like you can't.
I remember going to see The Social Network, walking out of the theater being like, fuck, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go start a company. By the time I got back to my apartment, I had forgotten all about it and I played video games.
Exactly,
like,
right. Just,
some people don't turn that off ever.
Yeah, you just got to. And if you do want to do that and you got to put in the work to learn how to do that, this man did not do that at all. And
yeah, right. You do have to actually do the work.
Let me tell you who doesn't give you credibility to your goddamn music festival is Ja Rule. Don't just grab Ja Rule. Like he is like the scion of music industry. He's been arrested so many times. It's just so ridiculous. It's so fun. I mean, it's fucked up because it's like it's us and it's why we are where we are right now. But it's just like, oh my God, guys, we are dumb as a box of rocks, and Billy McFarland is at the head of that. He's now serving 6 years in prison, and he owes $26 million in restitution.
Yeah, they'll get that.
they'll get that money. Oh, and they will get that money because they're not going to not get that money.
Well, something like Fyre 2 is going to happen or something.
Oh my God, I'm sure it is. I'm positive it is. It's just...
I do like this documentary too as sort of like some documentaries exist just to tell you what happened.
Yep.
Right. It's completely historic. And that's the whole point. And it's this, it happened and it's so absurd what happened that literally just telling it, and it was recent enough that they could have everybody involved talking about it and all that is it's enough to make a super entertaining movie. Like there's no extra stuff. It's just like, hey, you're not going to believe this shit.
That's literally what it is.
For an hour and a half.
Oh my God. It's so funny. It's so funny. So yeah, Fyre Fraud, guys. Do not watch the HBO one by Fuck Jerry, because Fuck Jerry was all about that Fyre Festival. Watch Hulu Fyre Fraud. It is so good.
Nightmare in Paradise.
There was no music.
They were put into disaster relief tents.
Slice of cheese on bread.
For 48 hours, it was the number one trending story on the news.
The media loves to write about millennials that are really rich, really white, spoiled. So when you have all of them stuck on an island having a shit fit, people were gleeful.
Other events that Kendall Jenner has been promoting, the Mount Etna active volcano raids.
You know, this like tsunami of schadenfreude.
That is my documentary, guys. Yeah.
Good choice. Good choice. And here we are now.
At the ultimate.
At the most important time of the episode.
Come on. Give it to us.
Okay.
Bring it on.
Well, my documentary was on Hulu also.
Uh-oh.
And it opens with on-screen text, and I will read it to you right now.
I'm very excited.
In 1996, some of the greatest comedy talents of all time came together to create a new sketch comedy show. What resulted was arguably one of the most spectacular failures in television history. Now, more than two decades later, they've reunited to tell the story of how it all came together and how it all went to shit. And then it fades out as the primary subject of the doc is making sort of wind noises, setting up a scene of an old man telling a fable of some kind, but he was really just sort of amusing himself by going, oh, one day, one couple of weeks ago, there was a sketch comedy show. And
it's not what I think it is. What is it?
Alex, holding for Alex.
There's like a couple ideas I have in my head, but I can't think of the names or
what.
No, you're gonna
go for it. You got us.
Okay, it is called Too Funny to Fail: The Life and Death of the Dana Carvey Show.
Wow.
Oh!
And it is spectacular. I've also, much like you, Alex, I've watched this at least 6 or 7 times, or at least had it on.
We had a month ago, we were airing on ABC. We weren't going to be on live, so we could record some sketches before the premiere. And we didn't really have our own studios. We were just in a studio on the weekends. We just frantically started writing, taping, just trying to pull the show together. Just, I guess we're going to do this, you know, because at some point you got to shoot something.
What? I worked on this movie.
What?
Yeah, I worked on this movie. Not anything exciting. I what did I do for it? I was an assistant editor. I don't know if I'm in the credits or not. I might be, but I remember watching, going through and having to log archival footage of all of these Dana Carvey show episodes and all these different things.
Holy wow. Shit!
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I've completely forgotten about it. And it was one of those things, you know, as like it was like a kind of a weird freelance gig. It lasted 2-3 weeks of, you know, oh, a cool movie about Dana Carvey. I love Dana Carvey. Mm-hmm. But I think I've seen most of it just through watching it, working on it. That's funny.
Wow. So it was directed by Josh Greenbaum, who also directed Becoming Bond and a lot of episodes of New Girl. And it's about basically this. What we can now look back on as this like super group, this super cast that at the time was Dana Carvey and a bunch of unknowns that were plucked out of obscurity by Robert Smigel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put these people together on a show today, you'd never be able to afford it.
Oh yeah. No, this is,
it is just ridiculous how much talent was on this show.
And now waiters who are nauseated by food.
Good evening. My name is Roger. This is my back waiter, Stuart, and we'll be serving you this evening.
I had a bit that I would do. I was a waiter for many years, and I literally would do this bit for the other waiters.
Our soup today is a creamy fish chowder with chunks of potatoes, corn, and scallops.
And so that was my bit. Waiters were nauseated food. That's not complicated. Carell had a thing that he did totally independent. It was a podiatrist who was nauseated by feet.
And there's so many factors that went into why it didn't even last 8 episodes.
Now, yeah, talk to us about this because why didn't it? Like what happened?
So here's what happened. Dana Carvey was on SNL for 8 years and just, you know, dominated SNL. He was like the primary player on SNL from 86 to 92. And then he gets out, he does some stand-up, he does, you know, little guest spots. But as soon as he announced he was leaving SNL, I think it was 86 to 92, but this Dana Carvey show came out in 96, so my years might be slightly off. But everyone wanted to know what he was going to do. He had offers coming from everywhere, and what he chose to do was attempt to do sketch comedy in prime time with Robert Smigel, who considers him the greatest sketch comedy writer he's ever worked with. Some people know him for Triumph, the insult comic dog. And he has since gone back to SNL, and he's just a great writer. And he's got one of those voices. He does characters on Bob's Burgers. You might know him if you heard him. But that's Robert Smigel. Anyway, gets him involved, and it's 96, 95 at the time, maybe. So they didn't have like the cable options and certainly no streaming options that you have now. They turned down HBO because they wanted a bigger audience because it's, you know, Dana Carvey was such a big star. Comedy Central was just getting started, so they weren't really in the running. And the number one network at the time was ABC. And so they went with ABC, and ABC promised them a Home Improvement lead-in. Home Improvement was the biggest show in the country at the time. And Robert Smigel didn't know anything about Home Improvement. They just saw it as like, okay, great, we're going to be on this huge network. That's terrific.
I had never watched Home Improvement. When I heard about the time slot, I thought, oh, well, maybe it'll be compatible because Tim Allen's kind of a man's man kind of guy, and seemed like maybe he's a hip comedian. He'd been busted for cocaine or something. I don't know, is Home Improvement a little racy maybe, right?
And then while they're in production, Disney buys ABC.
Oh, Jesus, no.
And they're putting together this cast. All right, here's who's in the cast. First of all, Louis C.K. was their head writer. Yep. They also, and at 29 years old, they also had Charlie Kaufman as on the writing staff. They also had as their showrunner, Robert Carlock, who has since won a ton of awards. Yep. And then they get Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert, and then some other great comedy actors, Bill Chong, Heather Morgan.
Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
Was he involved in the writing staff?
He was on the writing staff, dude. I'm looking at it right now.
They didn't even talk to him. Wow.
Dude, it's insane.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like this who's who of talent that nobody had heard of yet.
Oh my God.
And the 8 episodes that they created were incredible, but Dana Carvey was just more interested in trying new things instead of just doing like the church lady. So ABC promoted them as this like, hey, this is family friendly stuff. This is, you know, Dana Carvey. And they just didn't consider that, you know, just because a Home Improvement is high rated doesn't always mean it's the right lead in for you.
Yeah.
So the Home Improvement family audience was just not prepared for like edgy experimental sketch comedy.
Damn.
And the first sketch, which Louis C.K. was not involved either for obvious reasons. This only came out a few years ago. In fact, anytime anybody mentioned him, they usually like took a breath. Like, and then and Louis was there.
Damn.
I'll just leave that as that. But he referred to their very first cold open sketch, episode 1, as like a line in the sand sketch. It was Dana Carvey playing Bill Clinton, which probably could have been enough to please the masses, but they had Bill Clinton breastfeeding animals.
Oh my God.
with a duck ass. And the whole country was furious about it. They got letters. The ratings plummeted right away. And over the course of the weeks, the more notes they got from the network, the more the writing staff dug in. And they started mocking the network. And even in some cases mocking the
sponsors. Holy
shit. So they created a character of like this network executive that like mispronounces everyone's names and mispronounces Dana Carvey's name and stuff like that. And then they created a sketch within that sketch called the TV Watchers, where a family is watching TV and then they just push past them. And then it's like an episode of Seinfeld or like an episode of a popular show on another network. So you're like, you can watch all the popular shows, including the Super Bowl, right here on ABC.
Oh my God.
But it was really just like a fuck you to these network executives that were like, can you tone it down? Because we're really like not getting this. So they had this very adversarial relationship with the people who controlled their fate kind of from the get-go. And then the first reviews were horrible, but they got this cult following. And then some of the reviews went back and changed their minds, but it was just too late. They got canceled after 7 episodes. Their 8th episode even aired. And the 8th episode included what Robert Smigel refers to as the funniest sketch he's ever written. And it later aired when Dana Carvey...
Is that the Gerald Ford?
...hosted SNL. Yes! It's so, Tom Brokaw announcing... Yeah, go ahead, Nick. Sorry.
No. It is literally... I mean, you please tell, but it's one of my favorite sketches that I've ever seen in my life. Please say
totally.
It.
Well, it's Tom Brokaw announcing that that Gerald Ford was dead. And Gerald Ford at the time was not dead.
Tragedy today as former President Gerald Ford was eaten by wolves. He was delicious. Now that's just superfluous. I mean, you know.
It's a former president, Tom. What are you saying? He's not delicious?
All right.
So good. The other thing I'm seeing here is the ambiguously gay duo started on this show.
Started with the Dana Carvey show. And after it was canceled, it was kind of the only work that was there for Colbert and Carell, because those were the two. They were Ace and Gary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were they?
Yeah.
I never realized.
So they got to at least get a little bit of work in when Robert Smigel went back to SNL. He was like, it was kind of a lifeline to them after the show was canceled and before they got picked up by The Daily Show.
Oh, I love it. I love
it. So it's just so funny listening to them reminisce about it. There's my favorite moment in the whole doc is they make each person separately. They're all interviewed separately and they make them watch this promo. And first of all, it wasn't the Dana Carvey show. Dana Carvey, in a throwback to very, very early television, they had the the sponsor pay extra to be part of the name of the show. So 1 week it was the Mountain Dew Dana Carvey show. And 1 week it was the Diet Mug Root Beer Dana Carvey show. Kind of like college bowl games do now. But at the time, you know, back in the day, it was like, you know, Flip Wilson and Abbott and Costello would be like the Chesterfield Cigarettes presents Abbott and Costello, you know, whatever. So they had each one of them separately watch this promo for the show. And it started with a promo for this special episode of Home Improvement.
ABC Tuesday, a parent's worst fear, losing a child.
I don't want to die.
You never know whose family it will happen to. An episode so powerful, it hits home.
We beat this thing, no matter what it is, you know? I'm not letting anything happen.
And the voiceover guy's like,
a special home improvement followed by the Diet Mug Root Beer Dana Carvey Show.
And you just see everyone hit just burst into these gales of laughter. Oh, and Dana Carvey's like, that pretty much sums it up. What were we doing? But to me, it's so inspiring because it's like, it shows you that art and life are not meritocracies, and that has to be okay because you have to be able to risk failure. You have to be able to try things.
Yeah.
And now you can look back on it and be like, they did some great work.
Well, and you, and especially because you look at, you know, there's the whole thing with Dana Carvey, you know, and Mike Myers, and Mike Myers, you know, blowing up with Austin Powers off of something that ostensibly was Dana Carvey's, not the whole thing, but certainly the, you know, a lot of the Dr. Evil mannerisms, you know, being based off of Lorne. And that was very much apparently it was Dana Carvey's idea. Right. Mm. And so you look at this whole idea of, you know, this kind of very popular duo, one of whom just skyrocketed and the other of whom left SNL and never quite, at least in terms of our, you know, our capitalist mainstream idea of success, never quite found his footing afterwards, even though he did, right? He was, you know, he was doing stand-up, he was doing his thing, you know, he had this show. I mean, like, so it's not like he didn't have an amazing and continue to have an amazing career, but it's just one of those things where you look at how many factors have to come into play in order for someone to be a quote unquote success. And, mm-hmm. and like you said, this writing team and Dana Carvey, I mean, this is genius. These are literal geniuses. So for this not to work, it just gives you hope. Like, yeah, it's not about that. It really is about the endurance and about, you just have to go for it. You have to go for it no mm-hmm. matter what.
Exactly. And it's amazing the industry, like how risk averse it is. It's yeah. like, it's like, okay, this didn't work. And then, like, you're right. Like, Dana Carvey went back to stand up mostly instead of somebody being like, well, let's snap him up and give him another show. Like, what are we doing?
I mean, really, in movies and TV and everything, there's for every great thing, there's usually a story about how it almost didn't happen, how it could have been so different. The Galaxy Quest documentary that I edited was all about that, about how it almost never happened because, you know, the studio intervenes and something happens, an actor drops out and something happens, and some executive who's looking at it from a money perspective says, well, this isn't right. Let's do it differently. And the creators push back, and the end result ends up being the product of a lot of collaboration with people who maybe shouldn't even be collaborating, making decisions they shouldn't make.
But that's yeah. this speaks to why we need good people on both sides of the camera and on both sides of the stage, because you have to be that person who gives this, you know, gives the shot. You know what I mean? Like, it really, what we need are the people who recognize the art and who say, yeah, I'm gonna throw my money behind this. I you know, not to personalize this, but I had you know, I met with an agent once who was talking about, they were trying to get me to sign with their agency, and they were talking about how, you know, because I asked them, like, yeah, what are you doing for, you know, inclusion and diversity right now, and you know, helping to kind of, you know, further you know, the cause for those of us in the minority. And this agent's response to me was, well, you know, look, you know, black men are trending right now. We're following the trends, you know? And I literally was like, not good.
Talk about the wrong answer to that
wrong
question.
Wrong fucking answer. Like, do you mean, and I say that, it's not even, you know, besides just the pure racism of that answer, it's just like, that's what we don't need. What we don't need is you following the trends. What we do need is you having an eye on the trends, but also knowing when somebody like Dana Carvey comes along, you don't just cancel Dana Carvey after one show. You look at it and you go, cool, what did we do wrong? Maybe leading in from Home Improvement, not the best idea. Where can we put him? Because he's Dana fucking Carvey. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Insane. Yeah. People insane.
I'm glad you brought up I'm glad you brought up diversity, because that is one thing that this this show in my mind would lose points for. There's no acknowledgement whatsoever in the doc, by the way, of the total, and I mean complete, lack of diversity on the staff and the cast of the Dana Carvey Show. Yep. I know it was 96, but like, no excuse. And if they had anyone on the staff,
talk about that like it's like 50 years ago. Is like,
yeah,
you know, 96,
15 years ago, there was no diversity.
Yeah, exactly. Then. Like it's you know, Dick Van Dyke or something. But if there was a person of any color on the staff, they might have prevented them from making a sketch which Stephen Colbert refers to as the most racist sketch ever committed to tape.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it is real bad. It's real bad. Stephen Colbert says it. He says it with a smile, but he's like, I play Gregory Peck. I just want to be clear. I just want to that on record. But it's all about an awards show. Maybe it's the Oscars, but they're announcing best foreign film, and every filmmaker jumps out of their seat as though they won, but they're really just listing the nominees. But every one of these filmmakers is played by one of the white cast members, and every character that they're playing is a total stereotype. Oh, so God. it would have been career endingly bad in anything close to
I'm pretty sure that me and Alex have something like that in the vaults.
Oh, we've got a couple. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure we got one of those that if it ever found a, I think a good cop movie. You remember that? There's a certain movie that should never get out.
Oh man, I'm so glad that inside joke is going to stay inside.
It's going to stay inside. We're going to tell it to you, Michael, after we get off the air. But
I would love you to send it to me. I mean, yeah. Come on.
Oh my God, does it exist somewhere?
I think it does.
Somebody has it.
And they should never share it ever.
It was 1996. I don't know.
I mean, my first improv group that I ever worked with, we started doing sketches, and we recorded a sketch. This probably won't make it in either, Alex. But it was meant to be a cold open for when we did a show at Gotham Comedy Club, and we were gonna like go back and forth from taped sketches to live stuff. And it was just us in a car pretending to be drinking, and then it got more and more ridiculous. Like, we're playing drinking games, we're hanging a dartboard from the rearview mirror, and then it ends with on-screen text that says, "Don't drink and drive, you just might have the time of your life."
Oh my God.
Yep. So not a great message.
Not a good message. Even if it's tongue in cheek, you know, you just,
pretty funny,
just don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some stuff that, you know, you just look back and you say, ooh, that didn't age well. You know, and that's how we handle it.
Capriciousness.
Too funny to fail. All right. I got to check that out. I'm going to watch it.
I remember it just literally because I had to scrub through it and marking time codes and finding stuff. And I remember, I think I've seen it all from that, but I've never just sat down and watch it.
I can't wait for you to see it. It's on Hulu. It's so fun to just watch, you know, Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell reminisce and talk about these, where they came up with these bits, like waiters nauseated by food and Germans who say nice things. I mean, it's incredible. It's so fun to watch.
Yeah. Gerald Ford was mauled senselessly by a circus lion in a convenience store.
Good, yes.
Gerald Ford is dead today, and I'm gay. Now, wait a minute.
What? That'd be a huge story. Ford dying and you coming out?
But I'm not gay.
Today you're not gay, you know. Then one day you wake up, you like men, Gerald Ford dies, and we're screwed.
I love it. Well, dude, this has been nothing short of a pleasure and a privilge to have you on the show today. You got to come back. When this episode airs, pretty sure that your wonderful radio play will have just dropped. So, one more time, give
them. I cannot wait for that.
Yeah, give them the locales one more time. Just make sure
I'll give them all the deets. It comes out on December 14th. So if this airs by then, you can just pop right over to twasthenightplay.com or just find it in the Hamilcast feed. But you can find me on Twitter and Insta at mpsmithnyc. You can find my sketch comedy podcast, which features Nick Walker, Ted and Michael read sketches into microphones, wherever you get your podcasts, on Twitter at Ted and Michael or at tedandmichael.com.
Amazing.
So there you go. I'm a preparer. I had all that written down. I'm not going to lie.
That's what we Very love. Nice. You're prepared. You're ready to go. And that's what we want. That's what we want.
You know, why? I'm not even going to try to make it sound like it's off the cuff. I'm reading it.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Read it. Read it. It's time. Read it. But Michael, you are the best, my friend. Thank you for coming on. Thanks, Alex, I hope that your COVID fog brain lifts. And yeah,
it will lift. It will lift. And for all the rest of you, for a little justice, my name is Alex Smolo, and we'll catch you next time.
Fuck off.
Little justice, little justice, little justice. Fuck yeah.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.